Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisiscle.com/podcast.
This is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
I welcome Seth Franzman of the Jerusalem Post, war correspondent of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, and the author of the very helpful new book, The October 7 War, Israel's Battle for Security in Gaza, just published. I recommend for those of you who've lived the war as I have, and yet seeing it written down and broken into very clear paragraphs with names attached helps a deal remember what we've been through for nearly a year. Seth, congratulations and a very good evening to you, and I take you immediately to the evening of October 7th. I'm sure it's burned in your memory. You drove as fast as you could to Gaza, knowing that there was chaos in some fashion. You come to a police checkpoint, you stop your car, you get out, and there's a, I believe, blue car in the middle of a four-lane highway, and there's a sack next to it. What did you find, Seth, and what are your memories of that moment? Good evening to you.
Well, good evening to you. So, yeah, that day was the evening of the first day of the war, so the war had been going on at that point for about 12 hours or so. It was going to be sunset. And I tried to get down to the Gaza border as fast as possible. So I'd driven past some other police checkpoints near Sderot, which was closed off because there were terrorists there. And so I got to a place that was south of the city of Ashkelon, this highway. It's four or five lanes wide. And that highway goes directly towards Gaza. There's just several Israeli communities next to it, like Mordechai. And there's a turnoff for Zikin and some of other kibbutzim. So when I got down there, I think they had not hit me quite yet, the extent of this war or what was happening. And I got to a point, because I was kind of expecting you'd see tanks or fighter planes or things. I mean, there was some rocket fire, but it was what really struck me was when I got to this turnoff, and there was this police cordon, and I saw in the middle of the road all of a sudden this car that was kind of lodged against the median. And it was clear all of a sudden that was not supposed to be there. It was, and when I looked closer, it had bullet holes in it. And there was a sack next to it. And it was getting dark. So you can imagine when it's dark, it's harder to see kind of what things are. And as I got up to the sack, I realized that it was a dead body. And this body had been covered with a kind of sleeping bag or something, and some sort of debris, I guess just to cover up the face and stuff so it wouldn't be so obvious that there was a dead body there. But I later understood from people that I spoke to that they thought this was a terrorist. He'd been killed. And they were not going to evacuate the bodies because we understood at that point there were so many people that were dead. More than 1,000 is, and then, another 1,000 or more people from Gaza that had crossed over, terrorists mostly, that they only had space to evacuate wounded in the ambulances. And even in that case, there weren't enough ambulances because there were thousands of wounded. So those bodies were actually left there for another day or two before they were finally taken away.
The beginning of Hamas. I'm very helpful that Seth's book takes us to the history of where we came from and how it is we got to where we are. A worldwide catastrophe ongoing. So this is the middle of the conflict, or the end of the beginning of the conflict. We go to 1987, a man named Ahmed Yassin, who was deceased, I believe. Who was he, Seth? And what was his vision of Hamas?
Ahmed Yassin was one of a number of people that were Arabs, Palestinian Arabs, living in Gaza or the West Bank. Some of them were born in areas that had become Israeli, so they had ended up being, what was called refugees or displaced people. And they became enthusiastic in the 70s and 80s, basically about the idea of the Muslim Brotherhood and political Islam. This was, let's remember that this is a kind of interesting era of the 80s, because remember the Mujahideen are fighting the Soviets, and there's a lot of support in the region for Islamism or political Islam or groups that eventually would become, some of them, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt or Al-Qaeda or all those things. Many of these groups have roots 100 years ago, but they suddenly became very popular. I remember that Anwar Sadat, the president of Egypt, had been assassinated by an Islamist. So these guys in Gaza, they basically decided that Islam would be a better answer for the Palestinian movement than what was Fatah or the other groups in the PLO. And so when 1987 came around and there was this, the first intifada, which started actually in Gaza, it started after a truck hit several workers, and this caused protests and riots and a cycle of violence that led to the first intifada. So some of the founders, they founded Hamas basically at that time as an, in their view, an alternative to the other Fatah, the other movement. But the founders of Hamas, like Sheikh Yassin is one example, but people like Yahya Sinwar and people that were around at that time, you know, this was founded, yes, in some ways, a religious movement, but it was also founded as a terrorist mafia type of movement. I mean, Yahya Sinwar and some of these guys, they basically earned their reputation early on in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. They earned their reputation murdering other Arabs, and they were murdering people they accused of collaboration, and they were doing it up close and personal, you know, with their hands, strangling or killing. I mean, these people were, they emerged from a Khan Yunis, which was a gang-ridden town full of factions and killing. And they emerged as the absolute worst part of that. And their solution to the conflict very quickly became, you know, basically just killing. It was killing Israelis, killing soldiers, kidnapping soldiers, killing Israelis in Gaza, and killing their other Arabs and other Palestinians. And that's basically the milieu that they came out of. And whether it, you know, whether it's Ahmed Yassin or Antisi or Yahya Sinwar or Sinwar's brother or Ismail Haniya or a whole slew of other people, you know, that's what they came out of, and it's what they became. Most of them ended up, you know, a lot of these guys have been killed now. Yeah, I think Yassin was killed in 2002 or 3 or 4, I forgot, but Amran Tisi was killed. And many of them have met an end at the end of an Israeli assassinations, basically. But that's kind of where they came from.
Some are sent into exile, some stay in Gaza. When they return, they start suicide bombing, and then the second intifada. We're going fast because many of these gangsters haven't changed places since 87, except for now KIA. The second intifada starts in late 2000, and Hamas is not seen at this point as the major threat. That's the Palestinians on the West Bank. That's Yasser Arafat getting all the attention. I learned that Sinwar has been in Israeli custody at least once, maybe more than that, a known murderer. But because there's no death penalty in Israel, he's always been released. The last time, was he the one who was traded for Shalit along with a lot of others? Is that Sinwar?
Yeah, so Sinwar spent a long time in Israeli prisons. He learned Hebrew. He learned all sorts of other things. He certainly learned a lot about Israel. And he was released in 2011 as part of the Shalit deal. Let's remember that Hamas came to power in 2006 or so after Israel left Gaza and took out Israelis that lived there. Hamas won the legislative elections in the Palestinian Authority. And then they basically carried out a coup in Gaza in 2007 against Fatah. And prior to doing that, they kidnapped Gilad Shalit. They kidnapped Shalit, by the way, prior to actually taking over all of Gaza, which is a testimony to how powerful they already were. And Gaza was supposed to be part of the Palestinian Authority, and we're supposed to have, you know, European peacekeepers or whatever on the border with Egypt and things like that. Hamas had already grown so powerful. They kidnapped Gilad Shalit in a raid across the border into Israel. They held him from 2006 to 2011, and then there was this deal where like 1,000 Palestinians were released, including a whole bunch of people that went on to be very important in Hamas in Gaza, and Yahya Sinwar is the worst example of it. So he very quickly became the leader of Hamas in Gaza, and the other guys that had been running it, like Ismail Haniya, ended up living in Doha and Qatar after traveling around other places in the Middle East.
I'm speaking to Seth Fransman. He is the war correspondent for the Jerusalem Post. He is a member of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He is the author of a new book I recommend, The October 7 war, Israel's battle for security in Gaza, Seth did this with a great deal of attention to detail. It begins in, as we've just done, the fast history of Hamas. But when we come back, we're going to turn to the intelligence failure. And it is yet completely not solved, but there are pieces of it in Seth's book. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisisCLE.com/podcast.